Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The problem we have now is we're in the 11th hour, and we don't have a lot more time left.
Yeah. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on a Tuesday, everybody. It's the 19th of July today. 11th hour, right up against it, running out of daylight. Pick your verbal imagery, but there does seem to be a growing sense in Washington that all the fooling around's got to stop and real progress has to start being made. The president laid it out for reporters today at the White House briefing room.
So here's where we stand.
Yeah.
We have a Democratic president.
Right.
We now have a bipartisan group of senators.
That'd be the gang of six. They came out today with a new plan to make things better.
And we've got the American people.
Okay, wait. That's it? No House Republicans? And more to our purposes, no markets? Stocks have been up and down quite a bit lately, as you know. But forget equities for a second. Think about bonds, government bonds. Eerily quiet over there, which is pretty darn strange. Seems like if ever there was a time for bond investors to be a leading indicator, it ought to be right about now. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports from New York.
Treasury notes, T-bills, T-bonds, whatever you want to call them, they've had the reputation around the world as a sure thing. Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board.
For decades, the U.S. bond has been looked at as a haven of security. Folks have been willing to buy U.S. bonds even though the yield is, low.
Meaning investors were willing to accept low interest rates because U.S. bonds were seen as safe. But if the U.S. were to default and suddenly not pay interest on those IOUs,
it would destroy the bond market. You would see bond yields go sky high.
You might think all of the debt ceiling drama would have scared investors away, but it hasn't. The reason? Well, to borrow a line from Officer and a Gentleman,
I got nowhere else to go!
With some European economies floundering, there's still lots of demand for U.S. bonds. Jack Ablin is Chief Investment Officer for Harris Private Bank.
Bond investors are torn. There are very few places to put safe money.
At least in the short term. Ablin points out investors have been demanding higher interest rates for long-term debt, like 30-year Treasury bonds. Alan Levinson agrees. He's chief economist at T. Rowe Price.
If you think that the U.S. is headed to financial ruin, that may not happen in 2 years, but you're not so sure you'll get paid back lending your money for 30 years.
Even with those concerns about the future of the U.S. economy, interest rates are pretty low, roughly 4% for 30-year Treasury bonds. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
We were talking with David Gura yesterday from our Washington Bureau about some of the procedural things that are going to have to happen before there's a substantive vote on a deficit plan in the House. That chamber started debate on one of those things today. It's a bill called Cut, Cap, and Balance. Cut the deficit, cap spending, and put a balanced budget amendment in the Constitution. You've got to do it. Most states have to do it. Should the feds? Here's David.
Here's a bit of what we heard on Capitol Hill today.
Everyone has to balance their budget, except for the federal government.
Well, 49 states do. But should the U.S. government take a cue from them?
It's not easy at all for states to balance their budgets. And when times are bad in the country, it can cause enormous problems.
That's Norm Ornstein. He's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. When things get tough, states go to the federal government for backup. Ron Snell is a fellow with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
One of the reasons that states are able to maintain balanced budgets is that in the worst of a crisis like the one we've been through, there is federal money to help them out.
The cuts Congress is considering could wreak havoc in some states. They count on the federal government to help with unemployment benefits and Medicaid. Richard Brefault teaches at Columbia Law School. He says some states game the system.
Many states, even when they do have balanced budget requirements, meet their balanced budget requirements by all sorts of financial tricks.
They'll sell off assets and put off payments. But Ron Snell says the U.S. government couldn't do that.
The federal government has a responsibility that states don't have. States don't have to worry about the national economy.
Norm Ornstein says Congress has voted on balanced budget amendments before.
It's so seductive, and it's seductive to vote for, because you're wrapping yourself in the dual cloak of the Constitution of the United States and fiscal rectitude.
And in the end, you're voting for something that could spell trouble in the future, long after you're out of office. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You want to know which way the winds are blowing, the real kind, not the political kind. You lick a finger and you stick it up in the air. But when's the wind going to pick up? How hard's it going to blow? And for how long? If you want to make wind power work, those are the kinds of things you need to know. So Washington is trying to come up with the answers. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
If you're a weather freak, you know this voice.
Highs 95 to 100. South winds 5 to 10 miles an hour.
It's NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, their automated weather service. The robot gives general wind speed and direction a few times a day, usually from the nearest airport. Melinda Marquis at NOAA's Earth Systems Research Lab says that's not good enough for wind power.
No public entity regularly measures wind speeds in the part of the atmosphere where wind turbines are operating.
About 300 to 400 feet off the ground. The lab's Wind Forecast Improvement Project, you could call it WIFIP, will crunch wind data from turbines that are already up and running. It'll also test new sensors at two windy sites in the Dakotas and Texas. Right now, utilities charge wind farms, in effect an insurance premium, because they can't guarantee how much power the wind will make. Jamie Webster at PFC Energy says a better wind forecast means less risk and lower prices.
The system operator can get a better sense of what other resources, you know, say natural gas or coal, need to be brought online or not, depending on how much wind is going to be available.
But you can't change when the wind blows. Webster says in many places, the strongest winds are just after sunrise, when power needs are low.
Early in the morning, I may have a coffee machine on, and that's about it.
He says knowledge is good, but technology to store wind power would really get the market spinning. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
I mentioned stocks being up and down a lot. Today was up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a deceptively simple agricultural trivia question. What's the single largest irrigated crop in this country? Corn's a good guess. It's wrong, but it's good. Wheat? Yeah, no, not wheat. Try grass, lawns specifically. So wouldn't you just love to be the guy who invents a new kind of grass that promises to be lighter on your wallet? From Boston, Monica Brady-Myrov reports.
Lawns are green and pretty, but Jackson Madnick discovered their dark side 15 years ago when he lived on a golf course.
Within a year of moving in, my cat, who went outside every day through a cat door, got cancer and died. I learned from the groundskeeper at the golf course that animals there don't last very long.
Madnick suspected it was the fertilizer, so he started experimenting with different types of grasses. After 8 years of trial and error, he hit upon a mixture of 7 different seeds he says doesn't need fertilizer once the grass is established. It also shouldn't need much, if any, watering beyond natural rainfall.
Many people call it miracle grass or the holy grail of grass. It's not that. It's just that it's very slow-growing native grass and grows in many places that other grasses won't.
To get a good look and feel of the grass, we go to a lawn near his house.
So when you're walking on it, it feels very cushiony.
And it's a nice color of green. That was part of our selection of seeds.
Madnick is an electrical and mechanical engineer who's invented things his whole life. But this science experiment could make him a millionaire. Landscaping is a $38 billion industry. The patent is pending on his seed mix, but it's already being sold at Whole Foods markets on the East Coast and online at the Home Depot. Madnick is billing it as an environmentally friendly alternative to traditional grass seed. Neither retailer would disclose sales figures. Scott Edban has 25 years of experience in turf grass science and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He says large seed companies have developed similar mixtures but do a poor job selling them.
This is nothing new, so he does a very good job of marketing the grass seed.
A 5-pound bag of Madnix grass seed costs about $35, compared to around $20 for a bag of regular seed. But Madnix says users recoup the extra cost in lower maintenance fees. That was the main selling point for the town of Littleton, a suburb 30 miles west of Boston, where the big green lawn is king. Savos Danos runs the town's water department.
Having such large lots, for the most part, it's a struggle and a cultural issue of people wanting to have, you know, reasonably nice-looking landscape, and it starts with lawns.
For the past 2 years, the Littleton Water Department has bought 100-pound bags of Madnix grass seed to sell at cost to residents. So far, it's sold about 200 bags.
By us incorporating the use of drought-tolerant lawns, we can say, look, we're doing our part to try to manage the water resources holistically.
Madnix calls his grass Pearl's Premium Ultra Low Maintenance Lawn Seed. He named it after his mother. He remembers she always watched out for stray cats. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov for Marketplace.
Make way for the next big IPO to hit the markets. The real estate website Zillow priced its initial public offering in a statement with regulators today, $16 to $18 a share. Ticker symbol when it eventually goes on sale? Z, of course. The marketplace players offer their own Zillow appraisal.
IPOs.com. Can I help you?
Hey, it's Zillow. I've got a problem. Your website says I'm only worth $360 million.
Yep, that's what our stockstimate has calculated.
But I just told everyone I'm worth $500 million. You're way off.
Are we? I mean, last quarter you did lose $865,000.
You have to see me in person to understand. I've got a lot of character and charm. My backyard has plenty of room for an addition. I even have...
Yeah, keep in mind, the recent IPO for Pandora wasn't so hot.
I don't even do the same thing as Pandora.
Are you an internet-based company?
Yeah, but...
I'd say that's in the neighborhood.
You know, people actually use your questionable figures to try to drive down my price. Can I just tell you how ridiculous...
Oh, wait! We just made a change to our algorithm, which may affect the value of your company. Nope. That didn't help. Now our stockstimate says you're worth $40 million less.
This is crazy. I've watched how you value IPOs for 5 years now, and you're always way off base when it comes to prices.
So you're questioning the usefulness of our service.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
Okay, Zillow. I'm going to put you on hold for the next 5 minutes so you can think about the irony.
The always fabulous Millie Jefferson and John Haas had the starring roles today. Coming up, TV shows at a comic book convention.
The kind of people that like superhero movies, if they like something and they're on board with it, they sell it.
But first, yeah, let's do the numbers. Debt concerns? Dude, that is so yesterday. The Dow Industrials soared 202 points today, 1.6%, closed at 12,587. The NASDAQ rose 61 points, 2.2%. Finished at 28.26. The S&P 500 gained 21 points, 1.6%, ended things at 1,326. A glimmer of hope on the debt ceiling talks in Washington helped, yes, but corporate profits drove today's gains. IBM, which reported late on Monday, signed on new business far beyond what analysts had expected. The Dow mainstay rose 5.2% today. Coca-Cola beat profit estimates on the strength of business in emerging markets. That's a bad sign for the home market, by the way. Shares bubbled up 3.25% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.88%. See also Stacey Smith's story from earlier in the show. You're listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. you'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing. I kept that.
I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at Progressive.com. For a unique look at all of our Marketplace business and economic sustainability coverage, visit Marketplace.org and click on the Sustainability tab. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for June. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses how to fund improvements to our transportation infrastructure. And the first International Special Olympics was held on July 20, 1968 in Chicago. About 1,000 athletes from the U.S. and Canada competed. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. First of all, thanks for all the Google Plus invites. As soon as I figure out how to use it, I'll let you know. Also, and on a not unrelated note, do we really need more Google in our lives? Way before Google became a verb, Doug Edwards joined what was then a humble search engine startup as employee number 59, which, as it happens, is the subtitle of his new book. He was hired in 1999 to do brand management for a company that didn't really know what brand management was at the time. So when we talked, I asked him how a three-word slogan, "Don't be evil," became synonymous with Google's early image.
Well, Don't Be Evil came out of a corporate values meeting that engineer Paul Buchheit was in with a dozen other employees early on. And Paul is a coder. He's an engineer. And he thought it was ridiculous to have all these explicit rules because that's bad coding hygiene. If you can write one rule, why would you need 10 or 12 rules? And the one rule that he came up with was don't be evil. And it became hard to avoid within the walls of the Googleplex.
You know, I did an interview with Eric Schmidt a couple of years ago, the former CEO, and I asked him about data use, and he basically said, listen, you just got to trust us that we're not going to do bad things. Really?
It's a hard position to accept, but as a corporation, I don't think that the direction from the top down would ever be, okay, now we're going to go evil. You know, I mean, it's a very complex issue. I mean, privacy is something that is not as easy as, okay, you do a search and we won't keep track of it. You know, I knew the people involved, and I do trust that their ethics are solid.
You're a communications guy. You're a branding. You're a marketing guy. You go into this new .com company. Did they have an appreciation for what branding and marketing was, or were you kind of an appendage?
They did not like to use the word branding in the first couple of years. If I mentioned branding, you know, Larry would kind of wince or Sergey would kind of groan.
Yeah, this is Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
Larry Page and Sergey Brin. It was really a focus on technology and the engineering. So what I came to understand is that ultimately the product itself was intended to be the brand builder. I could contribute by working on the language that we used to build a more human interface for Google.
That's actually interesting because one of the iconic things about Google is that plain white homepage with, what is it, like 27 words by edict of the co-founders. And on there is this phrase, I'm feeling lucky, which, you know, wound its way up on the title of your book.
Yes. That is an element that is not something supported by logic. I mean, it was put there by Sergey because he wanted to show how the technology would deliver the answer you wanted on the very first result. What that means is, from a revenue standpoint, you don't see any of the advertising that Google would like you to click on. So it doesn't make sense for Google to have it there. And yet it's lasted a long time. And I think part of that is because it adds a touch of humanity.
Does the broader web searching public really understand Google? And I get that's kind of a metaphysical question, but do we get it? Do we understand it?
Well, Google is probably deeper than most people understand. So I think most people just get a sense of it as it's a very convenient website to use. It's a great tool. But it goes deeper than that, at least in the minds of the founders, about what it should be and what it can become.
Is it too successful, do you think? Is it too ubiquitous?
I don't think it's too successful because I think it works. If something else came out that worked better, most people would switch. Mm. So it's hard to argue that they're too successful because the product is too good.
Douglas Edwards was Google employee number 59. His book about his experiences at that company that we all know and either love or hate is called I'm Feeling Lucky. Doug, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Fans of Stephen King will be disappointed to hear that Universal Studios doesn't share their devotion to the master of all things really and truly scary. Universal's parent company, Comcast, that is the one paying the bills, has canceled what was planned to be a mega movie franchise and television series built around King's The Dark Tower books. The project was announced last fall. Ron Howard and Javier Bardem were attached, as they say in Hollywood. So why would the company spike a project with such headliner names? Sally Herships has the story.
Fantasy can be expensive, especially stories that span deserts, oceans, even portals to different worlds. That kind of magical tale appears to cost more than Comcast is willing to pay.
The Dark Tower is an extraordinarily ambitious project. It's also an extraordinarily expensive project.
Brett Lang is a reporter at TheWrap.com. He says it could cost more than $100 million to make just one of these Stephen King films. But Universal's new owner, Comcast, is frugal by Hollywood standards. Max Dawson is a professor at Northwestern University.
And as typically takes place any time one of these sorts of ownership changes occurs, the new owners have to evaluate whether or not they are willing to go forward with some of the commitments and investments that the previous owners had intended to make.
Dawson says big names like director Ron Howard and star Javier Bardem can be enticing, but they can also mean big paychecks.
If you're looking at your budgets and you're trying to reconcile your investments with the terrible performance that some of the divisions of NBC Universal have had in recent years,
you might also be apprehensive about pouring this much cash into a project which is almost George Lucas-esque in terms of its ambition. But Dawson says Comcast doesn't have to take chances. The company still has plenty of profits to fall back on from cable TV. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
130,000 very dedicated people are going to be in San Diego this weekend. They're fans, one might easily say devotees, of Comic-Con, the international comic book convention that descends upon Southern California every year about this time. 10 years ago, Comic-Con was just that, a lot of tights and capes and superheroes. Now it's more pop culture than anything else, and it turns out, a great place for television. Andrea Gardner explains.
Trekkies and Gleeks unite. Comic-Con will soon open its doors, and this year, many of the convention's sneak peeks and star-studded panels will come from the small screen. The major film studios aren't as involved this year, but more than 70 television shows will be at the convention. Entertainment analyst Marissa Gluck says Comic-Con falls at the right time of year for TV.
Late July is perfect to ramp up interest in September debuts. It's a little bit late in the movie season, in the summer movie blockbuster season, but it's perfect timing for the television season.
It's all about building buzz. A good screening at Comic-Con means more than just people applauding. They go online, they tweet, and share the news with anyone who will listen, says Comic-Con veteran Jason Enright.
The kind of people that like superhero movies, if they like something and they're on board with it, they sell it. Like, they sell it to their friends. There's something about the nerd fan that you don't get with other fans.
and they geek out about way more than just sci-fi and superheroes. They watch shows like Family Guy.
Frank and I just closed a deal to buy the Quahog Cabana Club.
Oh, wow, Brian. What else are you doing that's terrible and stupid?
True Blood.
Your blood tastes like freedom, Sookie. Like sunshine in a pretty blonde bottle.
And It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And I'm serious. I'll eat that eraser whole.
Those shows will be at the convention, by the way. So when TV marketers see those super fans all under the same roof, they want in. Dana Walden is the chairman of 20th Century Fox Television.
These viewers have essentially built 20th Century Fox Television. They are the collectors. They are the people who, you know, once they commit to our series, they're in for a long time.
20th Century Fox began attending the convention with sci-fi programming, like The X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But 2 years ago, it brought Glee to Comic-Con. The series is now a staple.
I think that Glee probably doesn't fit into the conventional, now outdated model of a show that would be showcased at Comic-Con. But really, if you dig a little bit beneath the surface, the Glee fan shares much in common with the fans of great science fiction or genre shows.
Convention goer Jason Enright agrees. He works at a comic book store in Burbank and says he's glad Glee has a place at Comic-Con, but he's really looking forward to discovering the next big sci-fi show. ABC's Lost ended more than a year ago.
At the end of this, we might not be talking about a movie for the first time. We might be talking about one of these brand new shows coming out this year, and there's room for a new king.
And loyal fans expect a lot. When they're disappointed, the negative buzz can be a new show's kryptonite. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. By Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film Snowflower and the Secret Fan, based on the novel by Lisa See. From Wayne Wong, the director of the Joy Luck Club, now playing in select theaters. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with no offense intended toward our more mature listeners. There's a new social network out there specifically geared toward the gerontological set. It's called Proust.com. Yes, that's as in remembrances of things past. It's actually more Proust questionnaire than Facebook, a chance for seniors to digitize their memories, assuming, of course, and this is the no offense intended part, that you can actually get your grandmother online. All right, that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow soared 202 points, 1.6%. The NASDAQ up 61 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 gained 21 points, 1.6%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed, and that is where you can turn in the morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here, Fannie and Freddie, public or private?
If it walks, flies, and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And Fannie and Freddie walk, fly, and quack like private companies.
Quack. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.